From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the machinery of war gathers steam, Saddam Hussein's options are rapidly diminishing, but no one expects him to go quietly. What will Saddam do up against the wall? Tonight on Point, two Saddam scholars, a psychiatrist and an historian, size up a dictator with everything on the line. We begin with the latest on a major disagreement among NATO allies. France, Germany, and Belgium have blocked a call for NATO to begin preparing for Turkey's defense in case of war. The three say they acted in an attempt to slow war. Today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the U.S. will go ahead with plans to support Turkey despite the allies' objections. Colm Lynch has been monitoring developments for The Washington Post. I asked what the dispute means practically and politically.
I don't think we've seen anything like it before, but my sense is that there's going to be some way to work through this. I mean, this is really becoming an issue of timing. The United States has hoped, and Turkey had hoped, that they could make a request to NATO to provide Turkey with some sort of defensive equipment and technology, some anti-missile equipment, some chemical weapons and biological weapons detection devices and that sort of thing, and wanted to sort of get this all in place in advance of a potential war. But those inside NATO who oppose war, the French, the Germans, and the Belgians in particular, were concerned that this would send the wrong message to the public. It would be, in essence, an admission that the path towards war was already set and that there was no chance of averting a military confrontation in Iraq. So they stepped in and essentially vetoed this request to provide some sort of protection for a NATO member, saying that, you know, there was no war as of yet and there was no reason to do it, and that if it came to that, they certainly would be, you know, willing to consider when the time came. But of course, these are the sort of things that you'd want to have all of these elements in place well in advance of a military operation. So it looks like it could become a bit more clear by Friday if there is a very strong message to the Security Council from the chief UN weapons inspectors that Iraq is still not cooperating and that the council starts to consider some sort of serious consequences against Iraq, then you might see Germany and France and Belgium starting to bend on this issue.
Colm Lynch, you've been watching these tensions within the United Nations in New York for weeks and months now. Is this now open rift in NATO an extension of the same debate that's been playing out at the UN?
Yeah, essentially it is a deep division, particularly between the United States and France and Germany. Germany has essentially aligned itself with France on this issue. France has sort of decided to take a very active diplomatic effort to try and prevent the United States from launching a military war and invasion against Iraq. It believes that UN inspections are working in Iraq. They're not getting full cooperation from the Iraqis, they admit, but they think that this is better than war. And so essentially, France is using all of its influence in the Security Council, its influence in NATO, to do whatever it can to restrain the United States. And there is a long history, particularly in the UN, of the French using its influence to try and, to a certain degree, contain the United States, to get it to operate inside the UN system, inside the international system, not to go it alone, and to essentially try to guide the United States to some degree. And that's what you're seeing now, sort of jumping out of the UN, and it's now starting to sort of play out in other international multilateral forums.
So do you see the NATO dispute and the Security Council standoff interacting here?
It obviously does, and the French have already indicated that one of the reasons, justifications that they made for not backing this request for support for the Turks was that the game hadn't played out completely. They said that they really needed to hear from the weapons inspectors first to see whether, in their judgment, the Iraqis are cooperating or not. So they're very much linked together, and any decision out of the Security Council is going to have a huge impact on any decision coming out of NATO.
And now we see a kind of apocalyptic language around both the United Nations and NATO, with Washington constantly drawing the parallel between the United Nations and League of Nations and the downfall. Abyssinia came up as the parallel to Iraq. is this language, this extreme language, saying the credibility, even the future of the UN is on the line, now NATO being pulled into that same kind of language, is it taken seriously, or is this a kind of game of diplomatic chicken among the high representatives here?
I think it's absolutely diplomatic chicken, but the problem is that you don't know whether you're sort of going to pull back in time or not. There's a deep sense that it's not in the France's interest to have a serious breach between the United States and Europe on this issue, and that if the United States is forced to go outside of the UN system to conduct a military operation against Iraq without UN approval, that the French will be one of the major losers. I mean, the only reason the French have so much influence on American action in the region right now is because they have a permanent Security Council seat, they have veto power, and that they can deny the United States international legitimacy for a military operation. But this is what provides France with its power right now and with its greatest influence. And if they're not able to resolve this issue and make some sort of deal and the United States goes outside the UN system, France will be a big loser. And that's why in the back of your head, you're sort of waiting for at what point are the French finally going to buckle? At what point are they going to cave? Because it seems to be far too damaging to France's sort of long-term interest to really go head-to-head with the United States on this issue sort of at the end of the day to really block action in the Security Council.
And finally, Colin Lynch, as you say, Friday's a big day. The UN weapons inspectors are back to report. In his last appearance, Hans Blix managed to slice it right down the middle awfully successfully so that both proponents of inspection and of military action could find something for him to say. Can he do that again? Iraq has now agreed to U-2 overflights. They're allowing Iraqi scientists to meet one-on-one. Does Hans Blix have to come down one way or the other this time?
Well, he's never going to come down clearly one way or another, but I don't think it was a 50-50 split last time. I think he really was leaning in the direction of coming to the conclusion that Iraq was not sort of seriously willing and prepared to cooperate with the inspectors. You had mentioned today the Iraqis announced that they would now, after all, permit U.S. U-2 flights run by the United Nations over Iraq. They'll also pass this law which makes it illegal to participate in weapons programs in Iraq. It's sort of a symbolic gesture, but something the U.N. had been asking for a long time. They're starting gradually to allow unmonitored interviews. But Dr. Blix, sort of in a press conference last week, said these are nice, important, symbolic issues, you know, the ones that I just laid out, but these are really minor points, that what he really needs is he needs serious, proactive cooperation on the key weapons programs that the UN has been monitoring for the last 10 years. These are things like anthrax, VX nerve agent, other missile programs, and that sort of thing. And on that count, he hasn't reached the point where he feels very satisfied with what the Iraqis are producing. So I would imagine that you would see a very tough briefing next week. He will take note of all of the helpful things that the Iraqis have done over the last week. But I think that at the end of the day, that he's going to signal very strongly that Iraq has still not made a fundamental decision to actively cooperate. What's going to be interesting is that his counterpart, the head of the UN's chief nuclear arms inspection agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, has been much more, I won't say pro-Iraqi, but he has been much more positive in his sort of evaluations of the degree of Iraqi cooperation. And so there has been sort of a widening gap in terms of the assessments by Dr. Blix and Dr. El-Baradei, and that will be interesting to see how that plays out.
And all that coming up on Friday. Colin Lynch, Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Colin Lynch covers the United Nations for The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from New York. Saddam Hussein's options are rapidly narrowing now. As war looms, he could go into exile. He could fight back with conventional forces and be eventually overwhelmed. He could break out chemical or biological weapons and try to rain death on U.S. troops, on Israel, on the United States itself. He could put the torch to his own oil fields, put a gun to his own head, and go out in a blazing inferno. He could surrender. He could slip away. But what will he do? Our two guests tonight have studied the leader for decades, dissecting his personality and his personal history. With them, we will look at the psychology and worldview of Saddam to try and imagine how the next 6 weeks may unfold, to try to understand Saddam Hussein at crunch time with his back against the wall. What do you think Saddam will do? If this is Saddam's final act, what will it look like? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 4-2-3-TALK. Joining me first tonight is Dr. Gerald Post, a psychiatrist who founded the CIA Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior. He is now professor of international affairs, psychiatry, and political psychology at George Washington University, and co-author of Saddam is Iraq, Iraq is Saddam, a profile of the Iraqi leader prepared for the U.S. government and published this week. Good evening and welcome, Gerald Post.
My pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Gerald Post, we're looking forward to this hour with you and with your co-author, Amitzai Baram, who will join us later. But you've written a big profile of Saddam Hussein just at the moment when many people around the world and certainly in the United States are wondering how this drama that's being cranked way up here is going to be resolved. And, of course, how he acts will be key to that. You have written that Saddam is often characterized as the madman of the Middle East. You say this pejorative diagnosis is not only inaccurate but dangerous. Why?
Well, to characterize a leader as a madman says he's unpredictable, can do totally irrational things. And in fact, Saddam is predictable in many ways and is indeed a rational calculator. Having said that, he has the very most dangerous personality, what's characterized as malignant narcissism, which is, when expressed in a political leader, has some very negative implications.
Malignant narcissism meaning?
Well, there are four components to this. First, such extreme self-absorption, such egocentricity, that he cannot empathize with the pain or suffering of others, including his own people. Mm-hmm. Secondly, paranoid. Not paranoid crazy, but ready to be attacked, ready to be betrayed, ready to strike out. Thirdly, no conscience, no constraint of conscience. He calls this the exceptionalism of revolutionary needs and revolutionary pragmatism. But basically, he can change behaviors very rapidly and always justify this. And fourthly, a willingness to use whatever aggression is necessary without any qualms of conscience. That's a very dangerous combination.
So if he's predictable, and we are now looking at a rapidly narrowing period of time and even circumstances that he's facing, we're going to talk about this in some detail, but is it possible to take a stab at trying to imagine how Saddam may respond to the walls closing in on him as war approaches or arrives?
Well, if we look back at his career pattern, this man is not a martyr. To the contrary, he's the quintessential survivor and will do whatever he needs to do to survive. But that means survive in power. There's been consideration given if he was really facing annihilation, would he accept exile, for example? And I think the chances of his accepting permanent exile, looking forward in his twilight years to sunning himself by a pool at some luxurious villa, between zero and none, because it's only a life in power that is meaningful to him.
But even if the option is death, Gerald Post?
Yeah. Now, having said that, he could temporarily accept asylum in some country with the motivation of returning with his inner core after the dust had settled to regain control and to continue to pursue his conquest. I think we have to remember 1991. After all, people were totally astounded at his being willing to go through that major obliterating air attack. What isn't understood very well is that 1990, his invasion of Kuwait, was for him a triumph. He had aspired since early years he was inspired by dreams of glory to be a world-class world leader, following in the path of Nebuchadnezzar, of Saladin, who liberated Jerusalem for the Muslims from the Crusaders, and then was later inspired to follow the path of Nasser. He considered himself one of the great socialist leaders.
It looked like a defeat to us, but maybe not to him in defying the U.S. Gerald Post, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We are talking tonight about Saddam up against the wall in the mind of the man and what he'll do now. Saddam in the endgame phase. How do you see Saddam Hussein handling the next 6 weeks? Will it be exile, chem bio attack on U.S. troops, suicide, surrender, destruction of his own oil fields? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Saddam Hussein up against the wall, looking at the mind of the man and what he'll do now. Saddam in the end game phase. If Saddam's back is against the wall, what will he do? Will he fight to the death? Will he run and hide? Will he attack Israel? Will he attack New York? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Dr. Gerald Post. He's a psychiatrist. He's founder and former director of the CIA Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior, now a professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and co-author of Saddam is Iraq, Iraq is Saddam. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-TALK. Gerald Post, stand by just for a moment. I want to bring Jack Beatty in. Jack, we admit that this is a fuzzy game we're playing tonight, and yet the end game, if it plays out anything like Washington imagines, is now coming into its final weeks, months, you name it. And this man is known to some extent. It's important how he responds. Is it a fair exercise to try and push our minds into the weeks and a few months ahead?
Well, it certainly is, and I hope that our government is doing it. You know, the authors show that Saddam is committed to two things that for a while look to be in consonance. He's totally committed to staying in power, and he's totally committed to retaining his weapons of mass destruction as an instrument of that power and as a form of deterring others from attacking him. But now these two are in dire and, for him, perhaps even fatal conflict. Mm-hmm. And I don't I guess I'd like to hear our guest speculate about, does he see it that way? And is it possible that there's a sort of last-minute change of mind in Saddam when he has to choose between staying in power and holding on to the weapons, that he will recognize the contradiction and give up the weapons?
Gerald Post.
Well, you've asked a rather critical question here. Why has he been so insistent, and at such great cost, in holding on to these weapons over the years? It's estimated, and I've seen varying estimates on this, but as high as $93 billion lost in revenues because of his insistence on pursuing these programs.
Through sanctions, through lost trade, the whole lot, you're saying.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we need to remember three things. One, as I noted earlier, he, in his own mind's eye, saw himself at long last as being world-class world leader, finally, in 1990.
The man that Nasser leaders, never quite became.
Right, and following in the pathway of Nasser, indeed. Mm-hmm. World-class world leaders have world-class weapons. Big boys have big toys. And at one level, that's been quite central to his psychology. Also, he was grievously wounded in terms of his conventional military strength by the war of 1991. And the weaker he has become conventionally, the more important it is to have that unconventional weaponry in order to compensate and still pursue his goal for hegemony in the Gulf. And finally, he has needed to demonstrate to his military, whose support has wavered, there have been major defections, there have been coup attempts, that he will defend Iraq's sovereignty, he will not permit the inspections, will not permit the overflights, that he has the courage to stand up to this adversary. And to yield on these weapons is to be seen as capitulating and is to lose that wavering support. So I see it as really highly, highly unlikely he could give them up, which isn't to say he might not pretend to give them up, but this is such a core part of his personality.
But as the war pinches in here, it becomes a case of can't live with them, can't live without them. The United States seems determined to take them away.
Well, but in fact, what the United States has indicated goes beyond that. And you don't have to be paranoid in his part to believe that we're out to get him. There
Certainly
was,
not.
After all, declaratory policy of regime change. Mm-hmm. And It's when he is back to the wall that his judgment can fray, and he can lash out violently. He did this on Exodus from Kuwait when he lit the Kuwaiti oil fields afire.
And we saw how that blackened the skies for miles and miles, right, for months and months.
An absolute ecological disaster. Now, what might he do if back to the wall in this circumstance? I would suggest three possibilities. Two of them, I think, are quite probable indeed. First, I think it is highly likely that he would order the use of chem bioweapons against alliance troops in the region.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, that he would order the use of chem bioweapons against Israel, hoping that could split further the alliance against him. And thirdly, could even light his own oil fields afire, as well as those of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, kind of, if I can't have them, no one will. But note I said he would order the use. I think this is a rather critical question. We have seen what seems to me a concerted public diplomacy posture on the part of our administration to split him from his senior officers. First Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said, his generals have a major role to play in the reconstruction of Iraq, but, of course, if they become involved in weapons of mass destruction, all bets are off. Then President Bush, about a month after that, said, his generals may well be ordered to use weapons of mass destruction. They would be well advised to disobey those orders. And I believe we are really not going to see the depth of the loyalty or disloyalty to him until it actually comes to conflict. Because in the last war, in 1991, those who too quickly stuck their heads out and welcomed the liberation were ruthlessly hunted down and eliminated.
You've written at some length about how keen Saddam Hussein's antennae are when it comes to loyalty and disloyalty, and that he's very capable of preemptively assassinating or having killed those around him who he even thinks may one day turn against him. Does he have that option now, or is he also waiting to see what happens when the crunch comes?
Well, this is a very intriguing question, and under pressure, his usual personality traits will tend to magnify. And I think there's something to be considered that might happen here. If you and I are both loyal supporters of Saddam, and he comes to suspect me and decides just to be prudent he'd better eliminate me, you, knowing full well that I am loyal, may well say, goodness, I could be next. And one can imagine if he starts striking out at his inner core, which is quite conceivable, that it could lead to an unraveling.
A kind of stampede away from Saddam Hussein.
Having said that, the question is, what is the balance between those who would stick by him to the end, who will go down the tubes with him, and the generals who wish to see their once proud military machine preserved, who do not agree with his policies but have afraid to voice them. And the problem is, as I've come to understand it, that he has put the buttons for these chem bioweapons in the hands of those who are with him to the end. So even if there are major defections, even if there are coup attempts, there are some who will go with him all the way.
The three steps that you've outlined as possible, even likely steps Saddam Hussein might take, that is chem bio attacks on U.S. troops, on Israel, setting Iraq's oil fields alight, are all super grand, large-scale, I suppose, measures. Is there a scenario that Saddam could opt for which would be a kind of quiet conclusion? Can you imagine him ducking out in the middle of the night, making himself scarce, running away, hiding, or even some kind of surrender? Are those out of the question?
I don't see surrender as at all likely. I do think it is certainly quite possible that he could encapsulate himself in one of the now, I'm sure, multiple underground bunkers. You know, the psychology of Saddam was nicely illustrated by the architectural drawings for the underground bunker that we found through the Germans in 1991. Mm-hmm. Here's this grandiose palace, quite opulent, with inlaid woods, marbles, Persian carpets, gold accoutrements in the bathrooms, and so forth. Under it, this massive bunker with reinforced concrete, steel, communications equipment, weapons, a helicopter with a disguised escape pad. This is his political psychology, a grandiose facade on the surface, but under it, a siege state, ready to strike out, ready to be attacked, ready to retaliate. And I think it's quite conceivable, in fact, that he could, with his inner core, be going into one of these bunkers, but giving up quietly, that I can't imagine.
Bunker life doesn't last forever. We know what that meant for Hitler. It wasn't a pretty end. I mean, there surely is no bunker where he can hide out in perpetuity. Or is
no,
there?
No, that assuredly is the case. But we, again, do need to remember, for him, 1990-1991 was a triumph. He had shown to his radical Arab supporters that he could have the courage to stand up to the superior adversary. He also believes, and this needs to be emphasized, that the United States suffers from a Vietnam complex, that if he can only bring significant casualties to American forces, there'll be protests around the White House and the Pentagon. There'll be a political military impasse, and he'll gain great credit for having had the courage to stand up to the greatest superpower on Earth.
So are you suggesting, Gerald Post, that he could try to hunker down in a bunker somewhere and hope that the U.S. Passion for this gives out before the Iraqi resistance does?
Yeah,
he emerges from the bunker as once again some kind of hero?
Well, after all, he succeeded in 1991. He's still in power 12 years later, and he does tend to have an optimistic sense concerning the United States' staying power. Having said that, it's my impression that he has a much more sophisticated and realistic view of U.S. resolve and of the international community. In fact, he's been quite remarkable in the manner in which he has redressed some of his misperceptions. Going back to 1991, he was startled by the degree to which his Arab neighbors joined the coalition. He has worked assiduously and patiently to mend the breach in what he calls his near abroad, his Arab neighbors and Turkey, through a combination of economic incentives, also through terror. And what was really quite remarkable was being invited back to the United Arab Summit in the year 2000, then at the economic meeting in 2001, the Saudi foreign minister publicly embraced his deputy foreign minister, a real sign of the penitent sinner returned to the
fold. The comeback kid there. Jack Beatty, Gerald Post is, against all American expectations, almost describing some kind of comeback trail here, a Saddam planning for victory, even at this hour, which I don't think enters into the calculations of many American minds.
Well, that would certainly fit that profile of grandiosity, the sense that he's touched with a kind of nimbus that makes him immune to the forces that bring down other men. But what I'm especially troubled by, and the authors point this out, is what you might call his Xanadu complex. That is, like Kublai Khan with his pleasure dome around him. It is a brave aide who gives him advice that he doesn't want to hear. In fact, you tell the story in your book, Doctor, that one of his aides suggested a kind of diplomatic face-saving gesture. And he was cut up in pieces and sent home to his wife.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point to emphasize. He is a rational calculator, but he often miscalculates. And one of the predominant reasons he often miscalculates is that he is surrounded by a group of sycophants who, for very good reason, are afraid to criticize him or offer constructive suggestions. And what the effect of this is, you can be, by psychological testing, in total touch with the reality, but could be, if surrounded by sycophants who tell you what you want to hear rather than what you need to hear, out of touch. The anecdote you're referring to occurred in 1982 when his the war he had started 2 years earlier with Iran was going very badly indeed. He needed to have a ceasefire. By now, Khomeini was obsessed with Saddam and said there'll be no ceasefire until Saddam is no longer president. He called an executive committee meeting of his cabinet, said, "Gentlemen, we have a dilemma. What shall we do? We need to have peace. But Khomeini says there'll be no peace until I step down." And at this point, his Oxford-educated minister of health, after Saddam, at first everyone says to him, "Well, Saddam, you must stay on. Saddam is Iraq. Iraq is Saddam." And he says, no, I want your frank, candid, and creative suggestions." Oh. And his Oxford-educated minister of health said, "Well, Saddam, you might want to think of stepping down temporarily until our goal of peace is achieved and then resuming the presidency." Really rather shrewd suggestion.
But as not shrewd enough.
As the story goes, Saddam thanked him for his candor, had him arrested on the spot. The minister's wife went to Saddam that evening and pled with Saddam for her husband's life. "Your Excellency, he's always been loyal to you." And Saddam promised her that he would return her husband to her the next day, which he did in a black canvas body bag cut into pieces, which powerfully concentrated the attention of his other advisors to a man, said he must stay on as president.
Sure they did. Gerald Post, I want to get one call in before the break coming up here, if you'll be good enough. Alan's calling. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Thank you. My comment or question to Joe is, Saddam Hussein is a chameleon politically. Originally, he was a Baptist socialist. Then he was sort of a fascist pan-Arabist. And now he's gone towards the Islamic fundamentalist leader here. And I think Saddam Hussein, rather than hiding in a bunker, might well put on the keffiyeh and the traditional Arab dress and go right to the main mosque with all his diehard followers. Everybody says, "Here I am. I'm in the mosque, and I'm staying here, and I'm meditating and praying for peace, and come and take me out."
But that presumably means death. Let me put it to Gerald Post before the break. Alan, thanks for your call. Can you imagine, Gerald Post, Saddam Hussein embracing death as triumph, going out in glory?
I really can't, and the listener is really quite accurate in his characterization. However, he has been re-Islamicizing Iraq, but that doesn't mean he's had a change of heart. He's been really ostentatiously praying five times a day. He built this immense mosque, the mother of all battles mosque, which has parapets in the shape of Kalashnikovs and Scud missiles, quite interestingly. And he has boosted the bonus for the parents of martyrs in the Palestinian struggle.
But you don't see him embracing martyrdom himself?
No, I don't.
We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about Saddam up against the wall, the mind of the man, and what he'll do now. If Saddam Hussein is rational, why hasn't he complied with UN demands? What does the psyche of this opponent suggest U.S. strategy should be? Do we understand Saddam Hussein? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Saddam up against the wall, the mind of the man, what he'll do now. Saddam Hussein in the end game. If this is Saddam Hussein's final act, what will it look like? Do we understand Saddam Hussein? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight has been Gerald Post, founder and former director of the CIA Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior, now professor of international affairs, psychiatry, and political psychology at George Washington University, and co-author of Saddam is Iraq, Iraq is Saddam. We're now joined by his co-author in that work, Amatzia Baram, professor of history at the University of Haifa, founder of the university's Persian Gulf Research Center. Good evening and welcome, Amatzia Baram.
Good Good evening, Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us. We've been hearing a lot from Gerald Post, and we're eager for your more historically oriented view as well. I wonder if you'd be good enough just to dive in for a moment and take us back to the very beginning. We want to get your view on what's likely to happen in the next month, two, three. But take us back to that beginning in 1937. Saddam Hussein is born to a poor peasant family near Tikrit, 100 miles north of Baghdad. And even before he was born, it struck me he was saved, as the two of you write, he was saved twice by Jewish benefactors before he was even born. How did that happen, Amatzia Baram?
I would say he was saved once, but over a few weeks. His mother lost her husband when she was at her fourth month of pregnancy or so. Mm-hmm. Then when she was at her eighth month of pregnancy or so, her eldest son, who was 12 years old, fell very, very ill. The Jewish family that lived nearby in her village, Tikrit, a big village, small town, took her and her ill child, her sick child, to Baghdad, where they deposited them in the house of their own family in Baghdad, another branch of the same family. They lived very close to the local hospital, and they immediately hospitalized the child. For 4 days, they checked him, and then they decided there was need to operate on him. They operated on him, and he died on the operation table. The result was that his mother was absolutely distraught, and she wanted to kill herself. She threw herself in front of a bus. But this was 1937. It was Baghdad. The buses were not buses. The road was not roads. Mm-hmm. And the Jewish family managed to yank her out of the road, bring her home. She tried to bang her belly against the door sill in order to abort the child.
Being Saddam Hussein,
she was prevented from doing it. That the Jewish family calmed her, and then they sent her with a cab straight back to Tikrit to the branch of the same Jewish family in Tikrit, and they took care of her. She stayed with her brother, but most of the days she spent with them. There were adjacent houses, and for about months or 3 weeks, they made sure she wouldn't do anything terrible, and eventually she gave birth to a very healthy and very nice kid.
But the formative experience for Saddam Hussein, as you describe it, is that mother was not there for him in her first months of his life. She, you speculate, had postpartum depression, essentially walked away from Saddam Hussein.
This is correct.
He was brought up by
his uncle.
His uncle, who and eventually reunited with his mother and a stepfather who was psychologically abusive. That failure of mother and child to nurture and bond, you say, is elemental to Saddam, whose name, you points out, means the one who confronts. He became confrontational.
Absolutely. He just now published in Iraq his autobiography, in which he's not discussing this whole affair in great detail, but he's saying, he learned it from an article of mine 11 years ago. He says, it's never mentioned anywhere else in his biographies, only in this one, the brand new one. He says, my mom didn't want me. He didn't say she tried to abort him, but he says she didn't want me. And she said, what would I do for her now that she lost her husband and her elder child and so on? And he says, yes, I had an older brother who died. There are some differences in terms of dates and so on. It doesn't matter. And he said, but he says, I forgave her. I forgave her. He even says, I forgave my father for dying.
And yet we wonder. Amatzia Baram, fast forward then to another critical time when Saddam Hussein is a young man. He's actually in Cairo, Egypt. Egypt's Nasser is the great hero of the Arab world and a role model to Saddam Hussein. Describe that view he must have had of Nasser, and I guess from there project forward to now. Now he sees himself as the new Nasser, as the new great leader or would-be leader. What does that tell us about how he's likely to respond to the pressures of these next weeks and months?
Yes, well, he really admired Nasser for a while, but he also worked against Abdel Nasser. He always works against father figures, George Bush, Gamal Abdel Nasser, President Ahmad Hassan al-Bakr, his own distant cousin who made him chief of security and so on. About Abdel Nasser, he saw in Abdel Nasser a model for Arab leadership, but he feels that he can be much greater than Abdel Nasser once he is the proud owner of nuclear weapons, and he wants to bring the Arab world back into the summit of world power and glory. That's his dream. What does it mean in terms of the next month or two? Well, first of all, the idea of him giving himself up, asking for political asylum, abdicating, is not very likely. Because if he does that, he said once, a few years ago, he said, I'd like Arab children, a thousand years from now, to be proud of me and of my regime and of Iraq and what we have done. And when they go to school, he said something like four graders, 10 years old. Mm-hmm. This is something which is very dear to his heart. So to ask for asylum means humiliation, means an end to the dream, and I don't think he'll do that.
But the full might of the United States military and others is now assembling around Iraq with what appears will ultimately be the goal of taking him personally down, quite likely his death, is he likely to see things that way, or is he likely to imagine that he with his, what you call his wounded self, will still somehow survive?
I would say that when he's absolutely certain that there is no other way to survive, he may give most or even all of his weapons of mass destruction. But in order for him to reach the point where he'll be 100% certain that all is lost unless this and that, the war has to begin. And the Americans have to be halfway towards Baghdad. And then it may be too late for him to do or say anything.
So will he use the weapon instead? Will he use it instead of surrendering it?
Maybe just one more sentence. To understand him, in addition to what Dr. Post told you, there was one more thing which I don't remember if we put or didn't put in our article. He is irrevocably optimistic. He is incurably optimistic. And he always feels that he can somehow survive and keep those weapons because they are very important for his role as the redeemer and liberator and victorious leader of the Arab nation. So he doesn't want to give this dream up. It's so dear to his heart. So he will wait until the very, very last moment, and maybe it will be too late. Because, to something which Dr. Post and myself are writing in our article, he knows that he was he managed to survive all these travails, all these troubles, all these the slings of error and arrows of outrageous fortune, and he's still there. He, a very poor, very miserable, uneducated, uncouth peasant boy.
And yet this time might be different. Amatzia Baram, Gerald Post, Jack Beattie, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Reg is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Reg. You're on the air.
Thank you. As I understand Saddam Hussein, he backed down in international confrontations in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, and each time came back stronger than before. The reason for the delay now is it's very obvious that President Bush has had an awful lot of difficulty in mustering American public support and international support to force him to give up his weapons.
Ridge, are you saying if there was just a united front, he would already have given up those weapons of mass destruction and to await a better day?
I'm saying that the difficulties Bush has had in mustering national and international support has made Saddam think that he can delay. Once he's convinced that he has a clear choice of either giving up the weapons of mass destruction or suicide, I think he will choose once again to be a survivor.
Rev, you've got it. Let us pick that up. Jack Beattie, I want to put that one first to you. Do you think, if Saddam was a perfectly lucid interpreter of what's going on in the world today, do you think that he would conclude that by giving up his weapons of mass destruction, he could survive and live for another day? Or is his name written on, it sounds crude, but a U.S. bullet?
Probably it is, but I think he could see a way to survive if he did that. And moreover, I think that the fissures among the alliance now and within the UN are probably giving him false comfort. And I suspect that he's counting on the French if not to veto, then to force the United States outside the Security Council to make war on him, and that this is really very counterproductive for the American effort to get him to face reality. Mm.
Frank's calling. Welcome, Frank. You're on the air.
Yes. I think that any discussion about Saddam's future has to be incomplete unless it includes a discussion about his two sons, Uday and Qusay.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that they're not willing to be martyrs, and both aspire to be successors and to power. Qusay heads the secret police services. Both have been described as psychopaths and are famous for brutality and for rape. They are 36 and 38 years old, and I don't think they're willing to die.
Frank, let us bring those into the formula. Thank you for bringing it up. Gerald Post, how do the offspring of Saddam Hussein figure into this picture, into his own calculations about what comes next and to those around him?
Well, the family that slays together stays together, and Uday was indeed the favorite son, a really wild man in many ways with untrammeled violence, kind of a chip off the old block. Mm. But Saddam became quite disillusioned with him when he blamed him really quite accurately for precipitating the defection of Hussein Kamel, which was his favored son-in-law, which was a great embarrassment because he revealed all the weapons of mass destruction programs. And he then ended up displacing Uday with Qusay, who, as the caller notes, is violent in his own right. Being able to achieve immortality through succeeding through his sons is indeed part of his psychology. But this makes it clear that we're not just talking about Saddam, but we're talking about the family almost in a Godfather kind of sense.
Amatzia Baram, I'm still having trouble picturing this final phase here. If Saddam Hussein misreads, if he thinks that he's going to have a last chance, when it's clear Washington doesn't ultimately, to my mind, doesn't want to give him a last chance at some point. They don't want the weapons. At some point, they want him out of there as well. He may realize that at some point. What happens then?
Well, I don't think that this is what he realizes. I think that he understands, or he also believes that there is a good chance that if he does indeed give up all his weapons of mass destruction and really cooperates with the United Nations, the U.S. will have no way of destroying him. They'll have to accept the international verdict that he has done as much as he could. I'd even say more than that. He's taking advice from the French and from the Russians. The French especially are advising him all the time. And the French are telling him that if you give up everything, you will be in power for many years, and your children can take over and so on. And yet he feels that because the U.S. is so constrained due to international circumstances, Germany, China, Russia, France, Belgium, whatever, there is no reason for him to give it up because chances are the U.S. will not be able to attack again.
Wow.
If they attack, I think that he has Plan B. Plan B is this. If they attack, he will try to create the impression using CNN, using Jazeera, using ABC and so on, international networks, that the American attack is so horrendously slaughtering Iraqi children, women.
That it must stop.
That they must stop. He will be hopeful that even when the first shots were shot, were fired, still he can somehow survive. I agree.
What a picture. Amatzia Baram, I apologize, but we are out of time with that. What a picture you've painted. Amatzia Baram, professor of history at the University of Haifa, thank you for joining us tonight. And Dr. Gerald Post at the George Washington University, professor of international affairs, thank you very much for being on. Jack Beatty, a breathtaking boldness there described in this last minute by our guests.
Yes, and last minute seems to be the operative word. This is almost the last minute, and the thought of he's waiting until they're on the road to Baghdad, that's past the last minute for him.
I guess so. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.